This is Law and Disorder.
You all know that the Hamdan decision came down slapping the wrists of the Bush administration. Hear now what Congress is up to.
Congress, the slimy, spineless amoeba that takes something good and will now destroy it.
Every day on the news, we're bombarded with horrific images of Israel attacking innocent civilians in Lebanon and the occupied territories.
The Bush administration is more involved than you think. The pillar that supports Israel's terror in the Mideast.
Lynn Stewart, our friend and comrade, is coming up for sentencing September 25th. The government has recommended 30 years.
A legal and political outrage, sending a message of fear into the heart of every lawyer who tries to defend their client.
Our co-host Heidi Boghossian will talk to you about presidential signing statements.
Forget about separation of powers. Now Bush says if he doesn't like the legislation, he's just not going to follow it.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Many of you have been watching Israel's brutal assault on innocent civilians all across the Middle East, from Gaza to Lebanon. We wanted today to discuss some of the legal implications of Israel's horrible actions and U.S. complicity in these assaults.
We're pleased to have with us Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis is an author of a number of books on the Middle East and on the U.S. empire, including the latest Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the U.N. Defy U.S. Power, that Interland published several months ago. Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks. Great to be with you guys.
Phyllis, we brought you on really to discuss the current situation in the Middle East, and particularly the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the occupation or continued occupation of Gaza and some of the legal aspects of what's occurring there. So can you first tell the listeners what led up to the current situation?
Well, it's always a question in that part of the world, you know, at what point you start the clock, at what point you begin the chronology. For the particularities of this instance, I would start, frankly, with the Iraq War that was beginning the process of changing the map of the Middle East, as
Which
George
one?
Bush put it, this new Iraq War. What's going on right now in Gaza and in Lebanon is very clearly a U.S. war. We have to be very clear about that. It has its origins on an immediate level in the U.S. response to the election in Gaza of Hamas, a Hamas-led government, and the U.S.-led international boycott and sanctions against that democratically elected government, all in the name of democracy. In the context of that, the humanitarian crisis that is now raging across Gaza began with insufficient food, insufficient water, no one could get money, the people who worked inside Israel, very small number already, was cut to zero. Even though Israel had pulled out its settlers and its soldiers out of the territory of the Gaza Strip, it remained in complete control by controlling the entry and exit of all people and all goods into and out of Gaza, controlling the airspace, controlling the coast. All of Gaza was under Israeli control, which means that under the terms of international law, it remains an occupied territory, despite the fact that the soldiers were no longer on the ground inside the territory. It was in that context that eventually, under such enormous pressure, Hamas decided to break their 15-month-long ceasefire, which they had been scrupulously abiding by. It was a unilateral ceasefire. Israel had not reciprocated.
A ceasefire based on what?
It was a ceasefire based on they were carrying out no military attacks for over 15 months. They were moving in the political arena, and they made a decision to reverse that when they carried out this raid just barely over the border. It was just a couple of hundred yards, and attacked an Israeli military post, leading to the capture of the soldier. And that's what led to the current escalation of the crisis on an immediate level. The Lebanon side of it, that began with, again, a raid across the border by Hezbollah, which, again, if the key question is the level of the chronology. Hezbollah attacked a military post, an Israeli military post. That attack was a violation of international law, no question. They crossed an international border. But the reality was that was a border skirmish. That part of the world is certainly no stranger to border skirmishes, and that particular border, the Israeli-Lebanese border, is no stranger to ongoing border skirmishes. Border skirmishes don't create wars unless one or the other party wants to escalate to a war. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. The Hezbollah embarrassed the Israeli military by succeeding at capturing one of their soldiers. In the response to it, Israel then moved back into Lebanon, attacked the Hezbollah arena where they were trying to get the soldiers back, leading to the death of 8 more soldiers. They didn't succeed, obviously, in getting back the 2 soldiers. And at that point, Israel began the massive escalation that we're now seeing today. They began it by bombing the international airport.
Yeah, I was
and
amazed
the major
by
bridges
that.
In the south.
I mean, apart from anything else you've said, what they seem to have done in Lebanon is just devastate a civilian infrastructure that
Absolutely.
Had nothing to do with supposedly their purpose of trying to get back the soldier or whatever they were doing.
Right. And I think the 2 things that are important to remember about that, Michael, one is that they were the ones who violated the Geneva Conventions on a massive scale by attacking civilians. The Hezbollah attacks on cities, which are also violations, did not begin until after the Israeli escalation to attack the airport and the bridges in the south that were cutting off people between the villages and the cities. Very similar in the attacks on infrastructure to what they had done in Gaza, where they destroyed the main electrical generating plant that provided electricity and water, because the pumps are electrically driven, for 860,000 Gazan Palestinians. That generating plant, of course, was built by Enron. And when the company that bought out Enron, Morgantine, the company from Connecticut that now owns it, saw that it had been destroyed by the Israeli Air Force using planes and bombs and missiles provided by the U.S., paid for by U.S. taxpayers, they went to the U.S. government and said, you insured us through OPIC, the
Overseas Private Investment Corporation.
Right. It's the sort of insurance company of last resort for overseas investments in dicey areas. They said, we now want the U.S. government to pay $48 million of our tax money to them to cover the cost of their plant, taking into account not at all the impact on the people of Gaza, who were suffering and remain in a set of crisis conditions. Now they're doing the same thing in Lebanon, where they are attacking the civilian infrastructure, claiming once in a while that this is the infrastructure of terrorism. But the tremendous irony is that they're making the claim that the Lebanese army is obligated to physically and forcibly disarm Hezbollah, right? And what are they doing? They're bombing air bases and military bases of the Lebanese military, not Hezbollah targets. They have not yet killed a single person from Hezbollah. They have managed to kill 205 Lebanese civilians and 25 Lebanese soldiers, not a single member of Hezbollah. On the Israeli side,
let me ask you something. You began with talking about the U.S. war and going after Hamas and what we've done, and what the U.S., the embargo on Hamas, et cetera. And of course, Hezbollah has a similar kind of reputation within the United States as being essentially a terrorist group, according to at least the U.S. government.
Right.
And it makes me think that the seizure of the soldier in Gaza, as well as the seizure in Lebanon, that the Israelis essentially use those as pretexts, because
exactly.
The way in which they're managing to carry out the war against Lebanon it seems it's been pre-planned for a great deal of time. And
that's
and that they were
right.
looking for a pretext. And if you go back to what you said about Hamas, they were looking for a pretext again to go after Hamas.
The areas that we're seeing, that we're able to see through corporate media and corporate TV and through, you know, electronic Lebanon, the images that we're able to see are not images of them going after Hezbollah and Hamas. They're going after civilian targets. These are the
right.
streets that were clear, that were crowded, that had a vibrant and thriving population that was recovering from years of occupation and civil war.
But Dalia, let me just interrupt with one point. I think that that is exactly why Michael's point is so crucially important, that this is not an instantaneous Israeli response to a provocation. This was indeed a long-prepared plan. The Israeli military has admitted they had this strategy prepared and on the shelf, waiting for the appropriate moment. A provocation, a pretext, call it what you will. This was a long-standing plan, and it means their long-standing plan was to go after civilians. Because whatever one may think about the politics of Hamas and Hezbollah, and I happen to have a lot of disagreements with their politics, they are rooted in the public domain. They are both major political parties. They are no longer simply military forces. They are both dominant features of the relevant parliaments in the Palestinian territories, the Palestine Authority, and in the Lebanese parliament. They are major players politically, but they also have a military side. Now, the reality is that the attacks on civilians represent an enormous violation of international law across the board. And there was, when I said earlier that this was a U.S. war, there was an extraordinary statement from John Bolton, somebody known for his extraordinary statements, when he said that it is, quote, a mistake to ascribe moral equivalence to civilians who die as a direct result of malicious terrorist acts, he's there referring, of course, to Hezbollah, and the tragic and unfortunate consequence of civilian deaths as a result of military action taken in self-defense, speaking of Israel. So it was an amazing moment when he actually said that it's not just a question of there's not moral equivalence between military attacks, but he's saying that there is no moral equivalence to the people. The civilians that get killed by Israelis are somehow not the same thing as civilians who die as a result of Hezbollah. And that is just an amazing
understanding. Is it really that amazing? I mean,
well,
the U.S.
Yes.
policy, it is something that Palestinians know, that Lebanese know, that the entire Arab and Muslim world knows, that their lives are not valued, and certainly an Israeli life is worth 200 times the amount that...
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's not anything new,
no,
quite frankly.
But it's quite frankly new for a top U.S. diplomat to admit it.
I think it says a lot that John Bolton's comments has not been met with a huge outcry.
It's important that we recognize what the effect of it is, though, because there was an official Israeli cabinet statement a few days ago, just two or three days into this latest set of escalations in Lebanon, and the statement said that what they called the, quote, low-key international response is, quote, allowing Israel the military freedom of action. So it's their recognition publicly and proudly that the fact that the United States, which is the only diplomatic power that has any capacity to influence or rein in Israel, the fact that they are allowing a, quote, low-key international response is all the green light that they need, and they intend to use it.
You had made the point that these assaults really do appear to have been long planned on Israel's sides. What was the motivation? What are they hoping to gain from this?
Israel seems to believe that they can defeat the historical reality that has been proven so many times before by global or regional empires, whether it was the U.S. in Vietnam or the French in Algeria or the British in India. They seem to believe that they can be the ones who can defeat a popular insurgency that has popular support by military means, conventional military means. It's never happened in history, but they are convinced that military might alone, that by just killing people and destroying infrastructure in all of the countries surrounding them, Palestine, Lebanon, everywhere they can, Syria next if they get their way, that they will be able to dominate the region in a way that they have never been able to dominate it before, which is to say to wipe out all resistance. That was their goal before. They took as a green light the U.S. position regarding Iraq, that we will reoccupy and destroy a country, destroy the resistance, and we'll call it democracy. They're doing exactly the same thing now regarding Hezbollah and Hamas in Gaza. We can only assume that the West Bank is next on the list.
Phyllis, can you talk a little bit about the legal framework that we're in right now and what Israel is actually doing in terms of the application of Geneva Conventions, violations, etc.?
The world has taken the position very clearly through the Geneva Conventions that an occupying power has two huge obligations. One is to end the occupation, that any military occupation is supposed to be a very temporary situation that is over as soon as possible. The second obligation is to treat the occupied population not just decently, but in a very humane way. The Geneva Conventions go through incredible detail about what are the obligations of an occupying power. It isn't just you have to provide sufficient bread and water so they don't die of thirst or starvation. You have to provide all the food that's needed, all the medical care that's needed, education that's needed. In fact, I was rereading the Geneva Conventions recently and found that there's a reference to the obligation to provide recreation. Who knew? The Israelis are supposed to be providing fun for the Palestinians. The problem is that the Israelis have taken the position that they are not an occupying power.
This
is
in
defiance of all logic.
Of.
In Gaza and the West Bank. And their years in South Lebanon, they denied it as well. They denied the applicability of the Geneva Conventions. The whole world agrees that the Geneva Conventions apply. So what we're looking at here is a scenario of absolutely massive violations of the Geneva Convention. The Geneva Conventions start with the right to life, that the occupying power may not murder anyone for any reason. No exceptions. Calling it targeted assassination doesn't make it legal. The Geneva Conventions say that no one in an occupied population can be punished for an act that he or she did not personally commit. So the entire notion of collective punishment, destroying an electrical generating plant in Gaza, destroying the international airport in Lebanon, that punish an entire population for the actions of a few people, whatever the view of Israel or the international community about those actions. I happen to believe that the Hezbollah initial raid was ill-conceived and reckless. I think they did it for reasons that had a certain logic, but I think it did not take into account the very likely result, which has been devastating for Lebanese and Palestinians. But nonetheless, whatever the provocation, whatever the pretext, the Geneva Conventions absolutely prohibit any kind of collective punishment. Separately, it prohibits the destruction of infrastructure. All of these things are being systematically violated through not only the ongoing Israeli occupation of Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem, but now with the attacks, the massive attacks on Lebanon. They seem to believe that through the use of enormous air power, absolutely untrammeled use of all of these U.S.-supplied planes and missiles and helicopter gunships, that they will bring Lebanon, not just Hezbollah, but all of Lebanon to its knees. And in looking at the Geneva Conventions, we also have to look here at U.S. violations, because the U.S. is the enabler of those violations.
The funder.
Not only the funder, providing directly the military equipment being used, the F-16 fighter jets, the jet fuel. There was an emergency shipment of jet fuel that the U.S. provided to Israel, reportedly from its stocks in Saudi Arabia. I don't have that confirmed. Clearly, the U.S. is making it possible for Israel to get all of the equipment to maintain the planes, maintain the bombs, sending them as many new missiles as Israel wants to use. And this is in violation not only of the Geneva Conventions, of which the U.S., of course, is a major signatory, but also in violation of U.S. domestic law, specifically the Arms Export Control Act, that prohibits the use of U.S.-provided military equipment outside of very narrow circumstances, which include only being used for legitimate self-defense or for internal police actions. None of this is underway in Gaza or in Lebanon. These are clear violations of U.S. law. So in providing, on a continual basis, both Congress and the Bush administration remain in complete violation of their own laws.
And you could also say they're, I think you may have mentioned, they're aiding and abetting war crimes, essentially.
Absolutely.
Because they know that Israel is committing war crimes, and they're continuing the support, in fact, the direct support of the fuel story
They're making it possible. The UN's human rights coordinator talking about the complete denial of basic economic and social rights. And that's a very unusual act for the UN to take, to coordinate a set of reports from its agencies on the ground highlighting this kind of violations. And the reason they did it is because they are so worried about what the humanitarian consequences are going to be if the international community doesn't end this so-called low-key response.
Even before Israel's recent actions, someone from UNICEF told me anonymously, they said, look, the situation in the territories is really devastating. No aid is getting to the people.
That's right. And we should note this is happening in the West Bank as well, where there are now over 700 checkpoints in this very small territory that prevent the transportation of food, of water trucks in many cases, even between Palestinian villages or between a village and the local city.
700 checkpoints?
Yes, 250 of them are permanent. The rest are what they call flying checkpoints, which may be in the form of just a truck.
You were there, Dahlia, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, it's been a while since I was there, but that's a shocking increase.
It's shocking, and they're all over. They move. People can't predict where they will be.
You took us back briefly to the Iraq War, the second Iraq War. Can you just give a little explanation of how you see that as related to what the current situation is?
I think there's two parts to that argument. One is that the U.S. war against Iraq has profoundly transformed the region. It has brought about not democratization, but a second major occupation. It has ended a scenario in which there were always two regional powers that had indigenous powers within the Middle East, one being Iran, the other being Iraq. Those were always the only two countries that had the combined requisites you need to be a rising regional power. Money from oil, water, sufficient water of your own that you weren't dependent on some other country, and a large and educated population. Only Iran and Iraq had the combination of all three of those factors. The U.S. war against Iraq destroyed the possibility that there could ever be another rise of Iraq in that situation, and there's now only one regional power with those indigenous capacities, and that is Iran. What it did was say to the world that you can use military force if you're strong enough and you're willing to sacrifice enough civilians. You can transform the map, you can change the map, and you can do it in without a word if you're powerful enough. The Israelis took that as a lesson, and they said, okay, we see now there's dual occupations, the U.S. occupying Iraq, the U.S. enabling our occupation of Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. And now we're going to go a step further using that regional upheaval. We now have a region that's out of control in many ways. There are people turning on each other in many countries because of new pressures brought about by the U.S. occupation. And in this moment of turmoil, Israel appears to believe that they could use that same model to impose a new regional order, to do on a regional level what the U.S. is trying to do on a global level, emerge as an unchallenged superpower in the region who could not be challenged by any other force. And that means they had to wipe out all possible resistance, whether from Hamas, now from Hezbollah. We don't know whether they intend to go after the nation states yet, like Syria or Iran or someplace else. It's important, I think, that we recognize that the neocons and others within the Bush administration who have been so staunch in their support, their uncritical support for Israel's violations and for Israel's expansionism, for Israel's nuclear arsenal, in my view, it's not because they are more accountable to an Israeli agenda than an American agenda. It's quite the contrary. It's because their perverse view of an American agenda requires an expansionist, nuclearized, militarized Israel as part of their global agenda. They need that regional hegemon, if you will, to do their work, do their bidding, and act as a regional power backed by the global superpower. So this is very much in keeping with the vision of U.S. foreign policy that has been at the heart of the Bush administration since it came to power 6 years ago.
How do we begin to change anything, have any effect? I know it's difficult, but what do you do now?
This is, of course, the crucial question. It's not enough to rant and rave. It's it's necessary but not enough to demonstrate at the Israeli consulates. We need to do that, but it's not enough. It's necessary but not sufficient to demonstrate in front of the White House. We need to do that, but it's not sufficient. First, we have to do education. We have to make clear that this is a U.S. war, that this is a war against civilians, and there's nothing collateral about it. This is a war designed to kill civilians. That's what the Israeli strategy and policy has been. So the first demand has to be for a ceasefire. Then negotiations. Israel has accepted the U.S. version of negotiations, which means you don't open negotiations, you don't have a ceasefire until you have military victory. Then you can start talking. That's an unacceptable reality, and civil society is, on a global level, is going to have to change it. We're going to have to rebuild that incredibly difficult but incredibly extraordinary moment that lasted for such a brief time in the run-up to the war against Iraq in 2002-2003, when you had this three-part component of a global challenge to war. You had social movements all around the world. February 15th, demonstrations in 665 cities that brought somewhere between 11 and 14 million people into the streets in every major city and most small towns all over the world. You had governments that, because their people were in the streets, because they had a few wealthy and powerful countries backing them, were finally willing to stand up and say no to the United States despite U.S. pressure and threats. And then finally, when you had enough governments prepared to say no, you finally had the United Nations at one moment saying no also and refusing to go along with the U.S. demand for legalizing and legitimizing this horrifying war. We need to figure out a way to go back to that, three-part opposition. When we can be, as social movements, as civil society, as activists, when we can be working powerfully enough to force other governments to recognize that it's not in their interest to go along with the U.S. either, and get the U.N. on their side, that we have some chance of stopping this horrific drive for war.
Phyllis Bennis has just published the book called Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the U.N. Defy U.S. Power. That just came out. We have Phyllis Bennis for the Institute for Policy Studies. It's been really terrific to have you helping us here on the air, Phyllis. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your great work over the years and particularly on this crisis, Phyllis.
Thank you all. It's wonderful been great to talk to you. Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Well, there's a couple things that Phyllis mentioned that I think deserved comment. First and foremost, she talked about the international obligations of an occupier. You know, whether or not Israel is required to provide recreation, let alone food and water for the Palestinians, I think we want to make it clear that we believe very strongly that the occupation is an illegal one, and they have no right to occupy these people in this land.
I think that's absolutely clear. I mean, they should have been out of
39
Gaza
years ago
and the West Bank a long time ago, and they should, at a minimum, go back to the borders of 1948. I mean, at an absolute minimum.
I mean, that
was an overreach.
Yeah, there is. We do want to encourage compliance with international law, but we want to also be clear about where true justice stands on this issue. And then the other thing.
Well, I think what Phyllis was saying about that is, when you're an occupier, you have an obligation to get out as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And whatever number of years, what is it now in the West
Bank? Years.
39 years. That is not as fast as you can.
The second thing is, she talked about Israel's inability to abide by international law. And Michael Smith, you actually sent me a great article sometime last year by Michael Warshavsky, who wrote, I believe it was him, who wrote a fabulous piece that, you know, talked about the fact that Israel's just, the nation's psyche is one that does not allow it to really abide by any kind of principles. And you see it in the absence of a constitution, that they're constantly changing laws allowing them to do things not based on principle, but based on their immediate desires and what their next political objective, whatever that may be.
Well, if they had a constitution, they'd have to write into the constitution that the Israelis have superior rights than the Arab population.
They would.
That's the danger of a written constitution. That's why they don't have one.
Well, you're talking about Israel right now.
Yeah.
Of course, we have a written constitution, and the president thinks he can set it aside altogether.
The constitution, I don't live and die by the constitution, but it gives you something to fight back with. You can take the government into court with the constitution. It sets out what you are supposed to be abiding by. when you don't have that at all.
But I just, question in this situation whether a piece of paper would make any difference to what Israel does. I mean, international law, as we discussed on the occupation, is 100% clear.
Well, that's the point. A piece of paper wouldn't. But we're not talking about a piece of paper. We're talking about principles. And they have not articulated those principles because they don't have them.
Well, they would have trouble articulating a principle that says that Palestinians can't buy the same land that Israelis can buy.
Exactly.
How are you going to say that in the Constitution? Well, we're in a terrible crisis that's obviously continued for a very long time. And it's this country that's, you know, the main pillar of what's going on in the Middle East.
Yeah. I mean, I think Israelis are actually better on this issue.
Oh, they are.
Much better on this issue
than
Americans.
There's much
Americans.
More free speech in Israel.
Not all of them, but
a lot of them. A lot of them are actually... it's been a while since I was in Israel, but at the time I was shocked because a lot of them were more reasonable than many of the Americans.
There's 2,000 soldiers who have refused to fight in any of the occupied territories.
Yeah.
You read El Haaretz, there's articles in there that you would never see in an American publication. Never.
Absolutely.
There's peace demonstrations in Israel now.
Yeah.
Yesh Kavol and others joined in a peace demonstration a couple of days ago. I've been following it closely because my brother Kim moved there 6 months ago. He's living in an apartment 4 miles south of the Lebanese border.
I remember that.
I called him up on Sunday. I said, what's going on? He said, I was going to call you. I said, well, where are you? He said, well, I'm at home. I should be in a bomb shelter, but I got a dog. If I turn the air conditioning off, I can hear the missiles flying over my apartment.
I just want to also say something about missiles and flying over your apartment and the equivalence, because in this country, you see a huge amount on how, you know, Hezbollah is, you know, launching missiles into Israel and they're hitting civilian populations. And of course, you shouldn't do that. It's a violation of the laws of war. But it pales in comparison to the massive violations the Israelis are doing in Lebanon.
This false even-handedness is making me sick.
Right.
I mean, you see it everywhere.
Yeah. The myth is tiny, ever-victimized, weak Israel. And the truth is, Israel is a regional superpower. It's armed to the teeth by the United States, including some 400 nuclear weapons. It has the third largest air force in the world. The missiles that are used are made in Seattle and Miami. They use F-16 fighter bombers. They've got tanks against stone-throwing children in the Gaza. The relationship of forces is tremendously against the Palestinians. And the propaganda in the United States obfuscates all of this. At least in Israel, you know, you can see it. The people there are soldiers. They've got more of a free discussion in their press than they do here. And there's a viable peace movement in the Israeli army. And those are our comrades. And those are the people there that we support. We'd like to see it develop up here.
Our listeners are probably familiar with, at the end of June, in fact, on June 29th, 2006, the Supreme Court came down with a relatively extraordinary decision. It's a case called Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. It was a case concerning whether or not the president could try the people at Guantanamo Bay by a type of court, which I call a kangaroo court, by military commissions. Now, military commissions are something essentially made up by the president. The defendant, in this case, Mr. Hamdan, and 9 others who had been chosen from Guantanamo, had no absolute right to be at their trial. They weren't allowed to see all the evidence against them. Evidence from torture could be used, and they had no appeal to any civilian courts. And this is, of course, under the theory that Ashcroft started, that Gonzalez had, and the president as well. Terrorists don't deserve constitutional rights, or any rights. Of course, how do you know they're, quote, a terrorist until they've been tried by a fair tribunal. They've been under a lot of fire. The case came up to the Supreme Court. Without going into all of the detail, the Supreme Court in a 5-3 decision, but really it would have been a 5-4 decision, except that Justice Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, was disqualified because he had sat on the lower court on the same case and had, of course, ruled in favor of President Bush, partly because he was, I think, suspected negotiating at that very time to be a Supreme Court justice. But partially, I think he probably would have ruled that way anyway, because he's a big pusher of presidential power. Anyway, the essentials of the case have been written about a lot, but the couple of key ones for me were, one, that it really slapped down the president's ability to think that he didn't have to obey the law and could do whatever he wanted in the war on terror, that he could simply say the Geneva Conventions don't apply and go forward from there. And interestingly enough, Justice Stevens, who wrote the 5-3 decision, quoted a quote from James Madison about tyranny. The Madison quote said that when the legislative power, the judicial power, and the executive power are all in one person's hand or one little group of people's hands, that's essentially the definition of tyranny. So you can see this court was really saying, I think, that what we have here, or we're moving toward at least a direction of tyranny, and we're going to put a stop to it. That, I think, is the broader holding of the five justices. The other holding that's been incredibly significant for the Guantanamo detainees, for detainees at Bagram, for detainees at secret CIA detention facilities around the world, is the fact that they said common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions has to apply to anyone detained by the United States in the so-called war on terror. And that means two things. It means, one, that they have to be treated humanely, and two, that they have to have trials with all of the judicial guarantees supported or that are normal for a civilized people. Think about that for a second. What they're saying is that the United States essentially, or President Bush, was essentially treating people in an uncivilized manner. But let's go to the humane issue for a second, because the Geneva Conventions now do require that people be treated humanely, can't use degrading treatment, and it's a very, very strict standard, much stricter than the United States was doing, which the United States was carrying out all these Rumsfeld techniques on people, from dogs to stripping, cold cells. Now, of course, post this decision, which again was June 29th, we see Congress trying to deal with this question. What should they do? What kind of trial should we have? And what about this humane treatment business? Now, remember, if you violate the Geneva Conventions, particularly the humane treatment sections or the judicial guarantee section, you're committing a war crime under U.S. law. So now you got a bunch of CIA people out there in the world and a bunch of military people saying, presumably saying, what are you kidding? We're going to stand that guy in the cell at 50 degrees, throw cold water on him, violate Geneva, and someday some guy may indict us. So they're very nervous out there. Senator Lindsey Graham, who got an incredible puff piece in the New York Times yesterday, and he's a stinker. He's the one who put the Detainee Treatment Act on the books, that tried to strip the detainees of their rights in court. And now he's being lauded because he's saying to the administration, we're not going to let you do whatever you want. But he gave an amazing interview. He said, well, look, there's some techniques. Is standing in a cell for up to 40 hours in 50-degree temperatures and throwing cold water on people, that should be allowed. And if the humane treatment provision of the Geneva Conventions prohibits it, maybe we have to change the Geneva Conventions. I mean, this is remarkable. This is a body of law that the United States originated under the Lieber Code during the Civil War, and that has been there really since, as far as I'm concerned, time immemorial. And here, for the first time, the U.S. wants to change
Michael,
this law.
Michael, what's the Lieber Code?
The Lieber Code came out of the Civil War. There was a man from Germany came over and saw the atrocities committed during the Civil War and said, we have to have humane treatment of captives or people captured. And out of that came the Lieber Code, was the U.S. code, and then went on to the Geneva Conventions. And here you have these congressmen, Lindsey Graham, lauded by the New York Times as being a voice of moderation. Maybe we got to change our Common Article 3. And even if they don't change the Common Article 3, they want to change the criminal provision so that if you violate Common Article 3, you're not going to be indicted in the United States. So Congress is once again, it's so disgusting. I mean, the idea of even doing anything with this Congress is an outrage. I mean, I don't know where else to go. I mean, the problem is they want to, part of them, the administration says, we want you to approve exactly what we, the way we try, want to try Hamdan, which is exclude him from his trial, not let him see the evidence. And part of them says we want to keep doing inhumane treatment.
Yeah, and then what they're also doing is they're not only trying to change the definition of the meaning of common Article 3, they're trying to change the meaning of what humane is. And they're going back and they're saying, but by saying, look, we've always treated these people humanely, you are changing the fundamental definition of what is allowed.
You know why they have to, one reason they have to do that, think about yourself.
They have to protect themselves.
Think about yourself this weekend. Let's say you were some CIA guy sitting at home this weekend. You're at home this weekend, you're some CIA guy, and all of a sudden the Supreme Court says Geneva Conventions applies, and you've just waterboarded a couple of people, and you're sitting there thinking, my God, there's a criminal statute on the book. When we don't have a President Bush here, some guy's going to go after me. So one reason they want to say that humane treatment includes things like this waterboarding and all this other stuff is because they're sitting there with a bunch of agents screaming, well, you're going to get us indicted now.
Yeah, and waterboarding, mm-hmm. to remind those mm-hmm. of you who don't know, is when you hold someone's head underwater until they think they're about to drown, and then you allow them up for a brief second to catch a quick breath and stick them back under. And this is what our U.S. military has been doing.
During the Law and Disorder panel, 10 Minutes to Midnight, at the Left Forum in New York, our hosts covered a range of issues, among them presidential signing statements. While many people may not have heard of signing statements, they represent a significant threat to the separation of powers. The president literally attaches a statement when he signs newly enacted legislation. The statements lay out his interpretation of the law, which may unfairly influence how the judiciary perceives these laws in the future. In a report to be released today, an American Bar Association task force will recommend that Congress pass legislation providing for some sort of judicial review of presidential signing statements. Some task force members want to give Congress the right to sue over the signing statements. Other task force members will not characterize what sort of judicial review might ultimately emerge. We go now to the Law and Disorder panel segment on presidential signing statements.
The Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild, Heidi Boghossian.
My topic is a very narrow one, presidential signing statements. But it represents a potent threat to the separation of powers doctrine. And President Bush has been taking advantage of signing statements more than any other president. So I'd like to give you a bit of history in detail. Signing statements are announcements made by the president and usually written by the Department of Justice when a law is passed that give the president's interpretation of the language of that law. They also set limits on the implementation of some of the law's provision, or give directions to the executive branch officials about how to administer the law. Presidents in the past have used these statements when a law passed by Congress has provisions that they do not like, yet they're not inclined to veto it. Nixon's statements, for example, often related to spending authorization laws that he felt were excessive and against his own fiscal policies. Before Reagan, only a few presidents issued signing statements. They were infrequent and they were usually politically uncontroversial. Bush has used signing statements more than any other president, issuing over 400 alone in his first term. Yet he has not vetoed a single bill, notwithstanding the claims in his statements that the bills were unconstitutional insofar as they relate to him. Rather than veto laws, Bush uses his statements to nullify the laws as they relate to the executive branch. In his first 400 statements, he used the term unitary executive 95 times. This theory, as you know, associated with conservative thought, argues that the power of Congress to divest the president of control of the executive branch is very limited. Most recently, the signing statement that attracted a lot of attention is the one he wrote in connection with the anti-torture amendment that John McCain introduced. Bush asserted that his right to supervise the unitary executive branch and asserted his right as commander-in-chief provided the basis for his interpretation of the law, which would clearly create a loophole to allow him to permit the use of torture when he sees fit. In general, there are several reasons why presidents would issue such signing statements. One is to express presidential appreciation to friends and political allies who have shown support throughout the legislative process. It's worthwhile for the president to express this gratitude when he will need to call on his friends in the future. Another is to make political points, and another is to chastise legislators. For example, Clinton expressed disappointment that Congress allocated $300 million more dollars for various water projects that he requested at a time when resources were extremely tight and he was focusing on deficit reduction efforts. Clinton used his signing statements to bring attention to congressional moves that partially shut down the federal government. Finally, signing statements are used clearly to leverage the legislature. When Clinton had a Democratic Congress, he made little serious use of signing statements. But that changed in early 1995 with a Republican victory. Our courts need to be extremely cautious in interpreting signing statements for two overarching reasons. First, as a constitutional matter, the president is not a legislator endowed with an independent power to create legislative history. And second, some recent presidential signing statements cannot satisfy standards for sound political decision-making, because these statements were clear attempts to settle contentious political disputes or to undermine the statutory structure. Legislators, and we can play a role in urging our legislators to do this, need to start asking why a president can issue a signing statement that essentially directs a government agency not to implement a statute as it was enacted by Congress. Such statements have come under the Bush administration to be a dangerous tool of presidential overreaching.
Law and Disorder recently sat down with convicted civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart to talk about her health, her approaching sentencing in September, and the leading up to her indictment and conviction. We go now to listen to the first part of that interview.
Lynn Stewart, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Happy to be here, Michael, and all.
And we're very happy to see you. We're very happy to see you looking so robust. You've got color in your cheeks. You've got a nice pixie haircut, and you look like you're ready to make trouble. But I wanted to remind our audience, Lynn Stewart, of course, is here and not in her law office because she was convicted of a felony. Lawyers convicted of felonies are automatically disbarred. Her sentencing is coming up on September 25th. That's one thing we're going to talk to her about. She was found guilty of a number of things, but really all resolving around the fact that years ago she issued a press release on behalf of her client, who was a renowned, quote, Muslim terrorist, the Blind Sheikh. And Lynn informed the Reuters news agency that the Sheikh had advised his followers back in Egypt that they should take a look at the ceasefire that was going on with the CIA-funded Mirabeq government and make their own decisions about what they want to do with that government. And nothing happened for 2 years. Bush got elected, and they might have slapped Lynn's wrist in the old days when Clinton was president. But after Ashcroft came in as attorney general, he flew to New York. He announced on the David Letterman show that they were going to stop this terrorist complicit lawyer. And sure enough, there was a show trial held downtown in Manhattan in the same courtroom actually that where the Rosenbergs were framed up and convicted. And same thing happened to Lynn about a year ago.
A courtroom and, overlooking the World Trade Center.
Yeah, not far from the
World
Trade
Center. And with mention of Osama bin Laden quite prominently.
Oh, yeah, there's good video shots of the guy. They tried to make an amalgam, you know, scared the pants off the jury. It was an anonymous jury. They brought him in a police car every day. And they tried to associate Lynn with terrorism and with the Sheikh and with the bombing of the World Trade Center and bombing of the USS Cole and the whole scare tactics that our listeners are very familiar with. And it worked. And now Lynn is looking at a government that's trying to put her in prison for 30 or more years. The sentencing is coming up, like I say, on September 25th. We all hope that you'll all come down for it. And we wanted to ask Lynn, first of all, she hasn't been well and was undergoing cancer treatment. We wanted to ask Lynn how she's feeling and ask her about this new sensational motion that her defense filed about how the government quite likely was spying on her as functioning as a lawyer, and some other things as well. So like I said, Lynn, nice to see you. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. I can report that my health, I have been roasted by radiation, and I'm a month beyond that, so I'm feeling pretty good. I'm getting my old energy back. I managed this past weekend to appear at a Mumia event and then at the Socialist Conference at their plenary, and on Sunday at a fundraiser for the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee. So I'm
you're back to your old schedule already.
I'm glad you didn't say my old tricks, but I'm yes, I'm feeling better. I do intend, though, to spend the summer in the country, watching the grass and my grandchildren grow.
Now, Lynn, sentencing is on the 25th of September. Are there plans to ask for your continued release pending appeal?
Yes, that's definitely in the works. But our motion to the judge, which actually will be filed the end of this week, is asking for a non-custodial sentence. The government and the probation department have teamed up as only they can, with a very little reason and with a great many begging of the question, to ask for a 30-year sentence, which is the equivalent of a death sentence, because I'm 68 years old. I'm not in great health, even though I'm feeling good. And it's just unlikely. Jail is a very hard place for elderly people. It's a hard place for anyone. It's an inhumane place.
So that our listeners are aware, there are several options of non-custodial.
Exactly. By non-custodial,
house arrest.
Right. We mean not going to a prison. That's what we're talking about. We could have weekends. I'll go in on weekends. I could have a sentence that's pure probation with community service. As a matter of fact, the sentence that is suggested is a house arrest of maybe the duration of as much as 3 years with community service. I'm happy to go to the Brooklyn Public Library in deepest Bedford-Stuyvesant and read stories to those wonderful children. So it leaves the judge his hands are untied. The status of the law today really militates that he can give any sentence he thinks is appropriate to suit the harm.
Now, what do they consider? What has the government said that the harm in this particular case is? Because no one died as a result of this. No, as I understand it, the press release, you issued the press release, and the press release said the sheikh recommends that the ceasefire is over. There was no deaths after that, no terrorist activities related to that.
And no, so as I understand it, they argued back and say, no, we're not going to do that. It was opening a discussion, as we've seen, and anybody who represents political people knows they're always sending out something saying, I think you ought to talk about X, or I think you ought to discuss Y, and should we take a resolution on that?
So what was the harm done here from the government's
point of view? Well, here's their perspective, and I actually, my co-defendant was using this analogy last night. That's Muhammad Yusri, the translator. He said, imagine that you're driving 50 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone. It's a heavily populated district with a lot of school kids out there, and they give you a ticket. Well, you take your ticket, and you say, okay, I'll have to pay the ticket. But let's say a month later they come along and they say, we're going to indict you for attempted murder. Because anybody that would have driven a car at 50 miles an hour could have killed people. Things could have happened, might have happened. You shouldn't have done that. We're going to indict you for attempted murder. And that's sort of what happened here. It mushroomed to becoming material aid to terrorism when actually all it was a press release. Nothing ever happened. But by putting this in front of the jury, by talking about things like the massacre at Luxor, which took place years and years before I ever even knew the sheikh, by talking about Bin Laden and holding him up in front of the jury on a screen that was probably 20 feet high and then saying, but that doesn't apply to Miss Stewart. You can forget that with Miss Stewart. We came to find out that actually the government instructs its U.S. attorneys to use Bin Laden in every terrorism case, whether it applies or not, because that's the image. It's like putting up Hitler. and then saying, now we're going to talk about these guys over here. So it definitely was a put-up job. We argued against it. We fought against it. We did not win.
What does this do to lawyers in their defense of clients? What does this do to the legal profession?
Well, you know, we're arguing now, one of the points that's made by the government and by the probation department is deterrence. But our position is criminal lawyers are very, very skittish about crossing over the line and jeopardizing their licenses. And surely the loss of my ability to practice law, as Michael referred to, that's a punishment that no lawyer is missing at this point. If they send me to jail for 30 years or anywhere near it, any intense custodial sentence, it will put representation of, quote, the despised or the unpopular into the deep freeze.
That's what worries me. When you were indicted, the first thing that sprang into my mind was in Florida. You know, so, I mean, maybe someone else here is more of an expert in this, but in Florida some years ago, they started going after the attorneys who represent criminal defendants in drug cases, in narcotics cases. By going after those attorneys, you take those attorneys out, and those are the best attorneys in those types of cases, and they go and they get the best attorneys, and you take those attorneys out. And not only does it keep the legal profession busy trying to defend itself or just doing its job, but it also takes out of the whole pool of attorneys willing to do this, everybody who's really seriously concerned about their lives, about staying out of prison, about being able to practice law, about, you know, being there for their families.
Yeah. Well, that's precisely the point. I think that's what Ashcroft was trying to do. He was trying to scare the attorneys. And I remember right after you were indicted, Michael Ratner went down to Washington, D.C. to do a training for all these white shoe lawyers that had volunteered to help the people imprisoned in Guantanamo. And these guys were scared to death. And they said to Michael, well, what if we go down there and we find out that our client's been tortured, can we say anything? And now this recent situation down in Florida with the seven people in Liberty City, like the poorest ghetto in Miami, they've been accused of conspiring to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago. The case is obviously a case meant to scare the population during an election year so they'll vote Republican. But, you know, in the old days, there would have been a lot of lawyers that want to go down there and defend this case. And now I bet you, because the scare the lawyers tactic works, unfortunately, I bet you there's a lot of people having second thoughts. Do I want to get involved like something this? What's going to happen to me? Look what happened to Lynn Stewart.
You know, these are seven young men from the African diaspora. You see their pictures on the front page of the Daily News, and people's reaction, and I think this is healthy, is, oh, no, we're not doing this again. That is rounding up people and then convicting them because they, at one point, under the lead of an agent provocateur, I would call him, from the FBI, were induced to swear allegiance to Osama, which is really weird in and of itself. My husband, Ralph, liked to say that if you're between the ages of 22 and 32 and you're living in Liberty City or you're living in Detroit or Harlem or Watts and you're not at war with the United States government, you must be insane. So if we keep that as the background, this would have been a natural case for that so-called band of intrepid lawyers that constitutes the political left to be down there and to be holding press conferences galore, to be putting stuff out originally. Unfortunately, I don't see that at all. I don't see any movement whatsoever, and I'm afraid to say I don't think it's going to happen because it just is a climate today where people can't run that risk that the government will come down and something which was for me, I thought I violated a prison regulation. I thought they would take away my ability to represent my client. Instead, I'm indicted. I'm facing 30 years. It's just incredible.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.